Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm Sandy Fowler, welcoming you to the Mighty Parenting community and reminding you to head over to mightyparenting.com to get your free email series on communicating with your teen, as well as to see what other support we have for you. Also, we are working on a couple of shows where we need your input. We want to know what questions you have about parenting, and we also want to know what you've gotten from the show this year. Like, did you have an aha moment? Are there lessons that you learned? Things that you tried that worked, or things that you tried that didn't work, or you found a better way to do something than what we talked about on the show? We need all that feedback from you. So if you could either email us, our email is connect@mightyparenting.com, or you can connect with us on social media platforms and message us or post it on our pages, whatever you prefer. We are simply Mighty Parenting on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. So please let us know what's happening in your world and also what you need. Speaking of worlds, in our Mighty Parenting world today, we are talking about a type of parenting that none of us ever expect to have to do, but that shows up all too often. Our co-founder, Judy Davis, found herself in this situation. She was parenting an addicted child. Her son Jeffrey's alcohol and drug addiction blindsided Judy, and she worked really, really hard at learning how to parent through that new phase of life. We've been good friends for years. I was there with her, you know, to hear about all that she was doing, and it was amazing what she learned to do. And Jeffrey is over 6 years sober now, actually almost seven. And around his last anniversary, Judy asked his therapist what his thoughts were about why Jeffrey was still sober when so many of the people he went through recovery with had fallen back. They had succumbed to an addiction again at some point or were actively in addiction again. And the therapist told her that a big part of Jeffrey's sobriety was because she, Judy, changed the way she parented and interacted with Jeffrey. So that insight just showed us how important it is for parents to understand how much our parenting impacts our children. And a lot of the things that Judy learned about parenting through recovery were just good parenting practices, whether we have an addicted child or not. So, wanting to touch on this, we are very grateful to today's guest, Kim Minch, for sharing her family's story with us. Kim is a certified parenting coach, an author, and mother of five who is passionate about educating, supporting, and encouraging parents, especially during the tween, teen, and young adult years. She actually was on Mighty Parenting back in February on episode 55. She was on the podcast, and on that episode, she shared tips for powerful parenting strategies that help you stop overparenting. She has also parented her son through an active addiction and has graciously agreed to come back and share their experience and insights with us. So, Kim, welcome back to Mighty Parenting.
Thank you, Sandy. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk with you again and to share this story because I think it's an important one.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like it's difficult to talk about. It's difficult to listen to. It's scary to think about the idea that we could ever be in that boat. But it's also amazing and powerful and helpful and hopeful. And so I appreciate you. I appreciate your son letting you share his story because, you know, a lot of people are like, no, that's private. That's personal. And in the fact that he's willing to do that to help other people says a lot about him and about you and your parenting and your relationship with him.
Well, as we were talking before, I have written a book about our experience, and he wrote the back portion of the book, you know, the kind of the synopsis of the book on the back. And I didn't give him any parameters. I just said, you know, he read the book and I asked him if he would write the back portion of the book, and I was amazed at what came back. So we haven't spent a lot of time talking about it in public. I can't say that I have. He hasn't, but he's also never alluded to the fact that, you know, please don't talk about this. I think he thinks it's very important to share the parenting side of what it's like to all of a sudden be in a situation that you know, and as we go along and I share the story, that maybe at first was a denial of the situation to a point where you couldn't no longer, you know, deny what was going on. So.
Yeah. So you actually just started right there. Let's let's go back to that beginning, because it's something that none of us as parents want to think about. We don't want to think about the idea that our child could become addicted. But addiction is a real problem for our teens and young adults, and your family has lived through this. So maybe let's just start, if you can, you know, share a little bit about what happened in your world, in your son's world, how this came to be, how you discovered that this, you know, that there was an addiction.
Well, I can start with my aha moment, which was a phone call from my son. Our home state is Wisconsin, and he had stayed behind. We had moved to Texas for my husband's job, and he had stayed behind with his dad, and he was in college and had a girlfriend and a job and, you know, was moving on in his world. He was 20 years old at the time. So in May of 2008, he called me on a Sunday evening, and he said, "Mom, I need help. I have just spent the day recovering from an alcohol binge. I don't remember the last 3 days of my life, and this isn't the first time." And that was my major wake-up call. There was things before then, and we can, you know, I can certainly talk about that, that made me wonder about what might be going on. But I mean, that was really the point of, okay, here's a child who is, you know, this kid is calling me and saying, "I need help." And I'd love to tell you that that was a very, okay, I got them the help they needed, and really quickly we got, you know, got it all straightened out. That wasn't the case at all. But that was my wake up moment that I could no longer deny. And that happens for parents in many ways. It might be a call from jail. It might be, you know, kids in the hospital. It might be, you know, something happens to wake that parent up. It might be finding an alcohol bottle in a child's bedroom. You know, that these things, it's the moment where you can no longer deny what maybe was in the back of your head that you didn't want to think about is actually happening, and you've got to do something.
I love the way you put that. The moment when you can no longer deny what's actually happening, because that is what we do as parents. You know, you had that phone call that was a wake up. And by the way, just so people know, Judy and Jeffrey shared their story publicly as well, and they authored a book as well. So I have permission to share their story here on the show. And anyone who listens regularly knows that you've heard Judy tell pieces of it. So, but you know, Judy got the wake up call that her son had actually attempted suicide. Mm-hmm. And that's when she found out he was a drug and alcohol addict as well. But it isn't always that there's that big moment there, and that's the first time.
Right.
That something happens.
That's right. These
little things. You know, my daughter had some health issues and mental health challenges to work through, and it was a similar thing. She wasn't a drug and alcohol addict. There wasn't anything. She didn't attempt suicide. There wasn't something like that. But there were little things that were happening where I was like, that doesn't make sense. And when I'd ask for an explanation, it's like, you know, maybe that's your explanation, but that's just not sitting right. And yet I just didn't know what to do. And I didn't want to face that there was a problem because I didn't have any idea how to deal with that problem.
Absolutely. Right there, Sandy, is what you know, it's like, I had this feeling there when I looked back, what, you know, of course I get this phone call and it's like, okay, what do we do next? That was, you know, forward thinking, but also hindsight thinking, like, look at all these things that I missed. And here's the one thing I did not do. And I'm so glad. And I can't tell you why I didn't do it, but what I didn't do was waste a lot of time beating myself up. I did not do that. And it was, it just, for some reason, it made no sense and was counterproductive to me. Like I was like, okay, I can no longer deny this. I did think back on the several times and things that, you know, should have triggered maybe more of a response, but I did not go to, you know, well, if I had done this, if I had done that, if I did, you know, there is no time when you love someone who's got a problem, who has said, I need help. My forward thinking was, okay, I have no idea how to deal with this. I have no friends that have dealt with this. I don't know what to do. But I do know it's not productive to sit and worry, you know, think about where I had failed and where I had not gone wrong. This child reached out to me. I need to move forward.
And I agree with you. And the fact of the matter is you're right. That's not productive. It does nothing. And in a sense, the situation is no different from any other learning opportunity in our life. There are things that happen to us all the time. It is simple as driving to a new location. If I have someplace I need to be, I have a destination and I'm going there and I make a wrong turn or I get totally lost, stopping and sitting still and beating myself up about how I should have brought a physical map because here I am in the middle of nowhere and my GPS isn't working, or I can't believe that I took the wrong turn. None of that gets me to my destination. It's all just making me feel bad and making other people around me feel bad as well. So I love that you didn't do that and that you recognize and share that with people. Like, yeah, yes, there were signs. and we're going to talk about that because I believe that talking about them in a different sense. I was going to say in a positive light, but that's not exactly what I mean. I mean, sharing them so other parents can know, yes, this is a sign that there is a problem or there's very likely could be a problem. This is a sign that you need to pay more attention or you need to dive in, you need to do something, whether that something is paying more attention or actively inserting yourself into a situation, whatever. But just knowing what those signs are helps. Because, again, I talk to other parents who've been through this. And a lot of the times we're just sitting there going, I didn't know. I really didn't know. And so it took a long time for me to piece all this stuff together and go, oh, this indicates a problem.
Yeah. I mean, and I in terms of like the things that I look back and I see the not so unique part of my son's journey is that his dad and I were together the first couple of years of his life. And I had him at the age of 18. So I had him very young. And his dad and I were together the first couple of years and then we parted ways. And so Nick went between two very different households for most of his life. So what made things, and my son is not unique. There's certainly a lot of kids that go between two different households, but I think what made it more complicated or what gave it maybe time to, but you know, he had one weekend at our house and one weekend at his dad's house. And there were two different sets of rules. We did not allow him to like do sleepovers, go on sleepovers. So when he was with his dad, there was a lot less rules. You know, there was a lot fewer rules and things that he had to, adhere to there. And there was less structure. So I have said this to my son, I really feel like during his growing up years, he didn't feel 100% accepted in either place that he was in. And I think that was a contributing factor to what started out as maybe curiosity with alcohol and ended up being a way to cope and a way to medicate his feelings. You know, he had a certain amount of anxiety going between the two houses because things were so very different. You know, As far as what I saw during his high school years, he was never a strong student. So I can't, you know, his grades like didn't, it wasn't one of those like the grades really fell, the friends changed. Those are two very classic, typical things that can lead a parent to wonder whether or not their child is, you know, getting involved in alcohol and drugs, is those major changes. But subtler things, like he would come to me and say, I really can't sleep very well. And at the time, my daughter was a newborn. And I'll be honest, with four other kids, my mind was in lots of other places. You know, it wasn't necessarily focused. You know, I was like, okay, well, you know, maybe we should try tea, or maybe we should, you know, and I ended up getting, I remember his drinking NyQuil and saying he had a cold. And I think the NyQuil was more about his sleeping. And I certainly learned while he was in patient rehab so much more than I ever saw. And it's unbelievable what you can not see when a child is living under your own roof. I mean, it really is. And it, and again, I acknowledge these things, yet I'm not going to sit in them because it didn't do any good at the time that he was in crisis. And it certainly doesn't do good for me now, as you know, parenting him. He's 9 years sober at this point, but you know, for other parents, I definitely think, you know, here's the thing, here's what I would say to a parent who wonders, what is your gut telling you? What is your gut telling you? And don't deny that feeling that's coming up within you, because I did have that feeling definitely sometimes during his high school years that things were going on that, but I, you know, like, so don't minimize your gut feeling. I'm, you know, super intuition is given to us for a reason.
Well, I want to talk about your feelings for a minute here too, Kim, because sure. So you're saying, you know, go with your gut, listen to that feeling. But we also talked about this idea of, as parents, how we will back away, we will bury our head in the sand. So what were some of the other things that you were feeling, you know, either ahead of time as you, you know, kind of saw some signs and indications that there might be a problem? You know, how did you feel when those things were creeping into your life?
Scared. There was a Sunday evening. This is so clear to me. I remember coming up the stairway and all of us except Nick had been out for dinner at my mom's house, and we were coming home. It was probably 7 in the evening and he had been at work. So I was coming up the stairs and it was nowhere near his bedroom, but I smelled alcohol. Like, it was the strangest thing. I was like halfway up the stairs and I'm like, that's really strange. So I walked down the hallway to his room and he was sitting on his bed. And I was like, what's that weird smell? Like, I mean, it was so strong to me, Sandy. And I'm not sure, I honestly think that might've been some kind of divine intervention, like for me to like get a clue. He seemed to talk fine when I asked him, you know, what's going on, you know, how are you doing? How was work? Blah, blah, blah. But the next day when he went to school, that was the first time I searched his room. And underneath his bed, I found a small, like, airline bottle, you know, like one of those little bottles of alcohol. I mean, you would never smell that. I swear to you. It was so strange how overwhelming that smell was to me. And that was like the first, and I, you know, that's just a kind of a strange, quirky thing that happened to me. But I would say, you know, and I remember finding that bottle and thinking, oh my God. You know, like, I'm scared. Like, I don't know how to deal with this. So I know after that, I watched him more closely. I searched his room, you know, to be honest, I don't think I would have gone to him angry. I think I would have, you know, I would have gone to him out of concern. My husband, another thing that was happening was, his stepdad, my husband, would notice that alcohol was missing from the cabinet, and he would come to me, my husband would come to me and be like, hey, you know, I think there's, you know, there's alcohol missing. And I would then go to Nick and I would say to Nick, you know, Tom is seeing that, you know, alcohol is missing from the cabinet. Have you been taking alcohol? Look him directly in the eye. No, of course, no, I'm not, you know, This happened a number of times, to a point where my husband was drawing lines on the alcohol and taking pictures of the way that bottles were set up in the cabinet. I mean, these are things that should have been, when I look back, I think, hello, red flag. But I will tell you this, Sandy, I do not know if I could have changed the trajectory of what my son was going to go through in the coming years, even if I had known then. You know, and I'm not trying to make excuses for myself. I'm just saying I'm not sure I would have, how we would have changed the path, because you cannot, no matter if it's a young person or an adult, you cannot change them. They have to want to get help for themselves. They have to, as much as you want to, as much as you love them and want them, you know, want to have them love themselves enough to get help, they have to be ready for that.
And that's so true. That was one of the things I was thinking about earlier, as you said, yes, there were signs before this phone call from him. But one of the first thoughts I had was, this phone call was his acceptance of the situation.
Yes.
And I'm not saying we should ignore the signs or that we shouldn't do anything about it. I am not saying that. But it goes also to that place of not beating ourselves up, but also accepting that idea of exactly what you said. No human being can make another human being do something or get help. We talked about this with Neil Brown on one of the earlier episodes. It wasn't in terms of addiction or drinking or any of that. It was just parent power struggles with their teens. And that was the big aha moment from that show. It is so stuck in my mind. And it goes to every relationship I have with another human being. I can't make somebody else do something, no matter how much better my idea is, no matter how much I love this person. I can't make them do that. And so I love that you sit in this place of accepting responsibility, but also recognizing that that doesn't mean that you could have changed. I love what you said. You could not necessarily have changed the trajectory of his life.
Right. Right. I mean, I could have implemented, you know, I probably would have gone to, this is prior to my understanding, intentional or conscious parenting. So I probably would have grounded him. I probably would have, you know, taken away all the, you know, the different things and whatever in my fear. And I don't know that any of those things would have helped him, because what he was doing was not necessarily, looking for a party or socializing or whatever. He was medicating feelings that he felt unable to share. And it was a long time before he was able, you know, again, and many more detrimental situations to himself and others before he made that phone call to me. And even in making that phone call, like I said, it wasn't an easy, like, okay, let's get out, you know, here we are. It took several attempts on his part. It took I think one of the most important things I would say if a parent is dealing with a child in addiction is that you've got to love and support them where they are without doing too much for them that they can do for themselves. And that it is so difficult as a parent to watch your child go through something that you wish they weren't going through something. But it's in those difficult times that our children figure out who they are, and they build resilience to things, and just that loving, unconditional support. And I imagine Judy would, you know, say the same thing, that it's difficult to be that presence for them, yet that is what helps them, you know, gain themselves back and love themselves enough to move through the addiction.
Absolutely. One story that comes to mind was Alex went into an inpatient rehab program. I'm sorry, Jeffrey. I called him Alex's little boy. We won't go into that story. But Jeffrey went to an inpatient rehab program and then went to, I don't know what the term is in recovery, but it was a house he lived in. He was just living
like a sober living house.
Yes, a sober living facility. Thank you. And he was in a different state and he didn't have a car. And I remember Judy just talking and talking and talking through this out loud to herself. And then, you know, periodically asking an opinion or whatever, because what she knew was the best thing was to keep out of it. But everything in her and as a mom is like, but he has to get to work and he has to do these things. And this is not crazy. And he's not asking us for help. So why shouldn't we offer it? And going through that whole cycle. And it was, I just remember it because I was part of, I was a fly on the wall and listened to her go through all of the painful moments of being a parent where there's something that you could do to help, but you know you shouldn't. And having to make that choice to let them struggle and yes. figure it out on their own and figure out, well, how do I work if I don't have a car? What other options do I have? And going through that. And what's really interesting though is, as I said, you know, at the time this is airing, Alex is just about 7 years sober. It'll be just a little under or a little over. And Jeffrey will be 7 years sober. And Judy and I have talked, and he is one of the most responsible and insightful people I know of any age, and certainly for his age. He's just in his 20s. But all those struggles, all that work that he did on himself, for himself, learning about himself, learning about interacting with other people in relationships, has put him light years ahead of his peers.
Mm. Yes.
But only because she let him do it. Like yes. you know, she sat there and she listened and she heard when they talked about how she enabled him, and he talked about how he would had her wrapped around his little finger to do things for him. And she went, okay, I'm not doing that anymore.
Yeah. And I think if you can have a support system through that as a parent, you know, I my support during this time really came from my mom. I mean, she really was a counselor, a listening, a compassionate, but also, you know, she helped me during that time period, but also almost the same thing, didn't do more for me than I could do for myself. I think that is so powerful. And believe me, my son like was sober living in Austin and, you know, had no job and had a record and he got a job in a grocery store way across town. And he ended up going to Goodwill and buying himself a bicycle and driving on the streets of Austin that were not safe, you know, and he had nighttime hours and, you know, all of these things to a point where you're like, I just, you know, but you just held the space. You hold the space and you will. And one of the worst, and I do want to say this, one of the most challenging times that he was in, I would go to bed at night and I, after the kids were all in bed and my husband was snoring, and that's when my emotions really came out, and I would lay in bed and cry. And I did not sleep well, but I finally fell asleep early in the morning for a couple hours. And when I woke up, I had this realization, and it wasn't a dream. It was a realization that I did not know why my son was in this world. I did not know what he had come into the world to learn or experience, and that all I could do was to love him and support him where he was at. And I had zero control over whether he was going to live, die, hurt somebody in the process, you know, any of those things. And it was such a peace of mind. I don't know if that sounds peaceful, but it was a peace of mind to me to know that there might be things that he's experiencing here that though I don't want him to, he's evolving as a human being through this.
Mm-hmm. No, I absolutely see, it sounds odd, but I absolutely see how that's peaceful because it takes off that pressure.
It's a little liberating.
You're not responsible for figuring out what he's supposed to do, how he should do it, and making him do it. And because we can't make another human being do something, that's a huge amount of pressure. And being able to let that go really works.
Yeah, it didn't make it easy. It didn't mean I was any less, you know, any less invested. It just was just a releasing, and a, like I said, somewhat liberating to feel like maybe there's a reason he's going through this, that this is his evolution that I have to just bear with as he goes through it. And I don't know what the outcome is going to be. Certainly it was very, very, it could have gone any way. It could have gone any way at that point. So
Kim, I want to talk a little bit about parenting, because we've touched on it a few times, and you mentioned the idea you mentioned that at the time when you were seeing signs, if you had not been so scared, if you'd been ready to acknowledge them, you would have done things like grounding him and being intensely disciplinarian about it. And it sounded like what you were saying is, you know now that that really wasn't the way to go. So, you know, if a parent's listening and they're going, you know, I do feel in my gut that there might be something wrong, or I've seen some signs that my child is addicted to alcohol or drugs, or just using them, abusing them, or there's so many other things. It can be gambling. It can be food. It can be technology. You know, there's so many things. If a parent is listening, they're like, you know, I'm seeing this, I'm feeling this, what are some options? What are some things that we can do in that situation?
I think that one of the important things that I did while in the darkest part of my son's journey was to work on myself. And that might sound like, okay, wait a minute, you're trying to help the kid in the situation, but here we're going to work on yourself. And that's in order to be emotionally available to your child. So that means that you have the ability to stay calm and to have discussions, because it's going to take more than one attempt at talking. If your child is involved in alcohol and drugs, it's going to take more than one attempt, you know, to get the kid to potentially be on board to getting help. You're going to have to develop a different kind of relationship with this child, and that child is going to need to see that you have boundaries in place, that you have the best interests of your child, which parents generally do, right? But what I'm saying is the taking away of things and the, you know, clearly, let me just backtrack for a second and say, if your child is driving a car and they're under the influence, then clearly you need to take the car, you know, you need to keep your child and those on the road, you know, safe. That's a definite thing. But in terms of being, you know, like sneaking around the room and doing all this stuff, you need to directly sit down and speak with your child about what you're seeing, about what's going on, about what your concerns are and why you're concerned about these things. And not in a way that has a tone of voice that makes them feel like you're talking down to them, but rather that you really genuinely have their interest at heart. Alcohol and drug addiction is obviously something that, you know, continues and at times gets better and gets worse with our teenagers. But we have to be open a dialogue with them and build a relationship around the communication being open and honest with one another. And if your child, chances are, if they're under the influence of drugs and alcohol, first of all, talking to them when they're under the influence is going to get you nowhere. I mean, it's really not. You have to be in it. You have to be able to talk to them at a time when they're not, you know, drunk or stoned, because you can't reason with someone while they're in the process of that. Go ahead.
No, so what I'm hearing you say is that we aren't going to be able to discipline this problem away, because addiction isn't a choice. It's not something somebody just says, well, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I want to do. There are reasons that they started using drugs and alcohol.
Yes, I think, and look at that. I mean, that's a very good point, Sandy. I guess that's what, you know, it's like, this is the behavior, but the behavior is a symptom of something else that's going on. What's going on with my child? Whether they're out partying and they're very, very social or whatever, and you think, well, maybe they're just, you know, recreationally using and whatnot. There's, if there's been instances where your child is progressively, let's say they get in trouble, and that doesn't really deter them, there you continue to see a pattern of that, there's something else going on. And it's your job as a parent to get curious about what's going on beneath this behavior, because the behavior is a symptom of something else. I wish I would have brought things that I was seeing to the attention of my son and said, I'd like us to find a way to get you help. And I would have tried to find a counselor that met his needs, or someone that he could talk to that he could trust that met his needs. I would not feel like as a parent I have to answer this whole thing myself, but I need help with this for sure. And I want to find the help that is going to be best for him. But I think being punitive as a first defense is not helpful in this situation.
And the punitive piece, I mean, as you said, there are safety issues. So yes, we need to look at the safety aspect of it. But otherwise, it's generally about getting our child help. And that comes from conversation. And so if you're listening today and you're like, well, yeah, I know, you know, sometimes my kid drinks or they smoke some marijuana, but it's not an addiction. Great. I'm glad. I would still open up those conversations and begin working on yourself. This is what we teach at Mighty Parenting. This is why we keep talking about these things, because the base relationship, the working on ourselves as parents, being people we need to be, being present for our kids as we're parenting them, but doing it in a loving and caring way, that opens the door for going, even if they're just, say they're doing some social drinking. Well, why? You know, what is it about that? And find out if they're doing it because they really like this, because they're feeling pressured. It just open those doors and start those conversations and yeah. Start building that foundation that hopefully will not be something that needs to be explored in great detail. But if there is a bigger issue, or even if this is just a small issue, if you can start talking about, yeah, you know, when I was in school, I felt pressured to do this, or sometimes I drank or I smoked because I felt this way. Now I've learned other ways of dealing with my feelings. And so, yes, you'll see, I'll still have a drink, but I don't drink to deal with my feelings. Mm-hmm. And start those talks and things. And I know, Kim, this is something that you came to later, as you said before. Did you find that shifting that parenting style impacted your relationships with your younger kids? Because this was absolutely your oldest son.
Yes, absolutely. There's no question about it. So when I learned, first of all, when I started working on myself, and this was in tandem with what was going on with my son, so I started really looking at the way that I was parented and the way that I was parenting my children. And at the time, Nick was 20 and my youngest was 3. Okay, so there's a huge gap there. 4 boys and my youngest is my only girl. It really, you know, when I started working on myself and looking at the way I was parented and what worked and what didn't work and how I wanted to build this long-term relationship with my children, adolescence is a phase of the, and it's a big phase because it starts, you know, in the neighborhood of age 10 and goes to their mid 20s. It's a long phase of their life, but it is a phase of their life. And you want to build a relationship that doesn't end as an adult, or, you know, becomes constrained as an adult because of what went on during the teenage years between the parent and the child. So it was important to me to really study and think about how I really wanted to be a parent. I knew I didn't want to be a friend, but I also knew that the punitive way that my parents had, you know, they were always grounding me for something, all of, you know, the grades, the this, the that, this never worked for me. And so I thought about this. And then what I did was I realized I wanted to parent with my children, not over my children. And so fast forward, my children today are, my youngest daughter is 14. She's heading into high school. I have a son that's 16 who's a junior in high school. I have one in college. I have one who's in the midst of seminary. He's in his mid-20s. And then Nick will be 32 next month. So I've really built relationships. My daughter, you know, it's very different. Girls and boys are very different in terms of when they'll open up and how much they'll open up, right? And it's been that way since she was little. So at this point, though, because my kids, because I use a couple of different phrases with them, if they're in a tough time, I will say, how can I best support you? How can mom best support you? This is my go-to statement. And sometimes they don't know, and sometimes they'll come back and tell me. But I think when we build communication with our teenagers, and we want them to open up, they generally have to feel that we are on their side, not their friend, but that we are on their side, that we are invested in their success as a human being. You know, so again, I at this point, this is going to sound strange, but I'm going to tell you this because this is our family and our story. So my son is home from college this summer, and every night at 11 o'clock, we meet in my 16-year-old son's bedroom, and the 14, the 16, and the 21-year-old son, or the kids, and I talk about whatever went on in our day. And we might talk for a half hour, we might talk for 45 minutes, but every single night, that is what we do. And it's not because I've told them, they've invited me into that.
So that is beautiful.
It is. I'm so blessed. I feel so blessed, but I think it's because I took time to hear my kids. We have structure. We do have some rules, but I don't have so many rules that they feel confined. I'm really curious about who they are and who they're developing into. That's my focus. So yes, we have some rules, but they get a whole lot of choice in their lives as well to explore who they are and not who they think they need to be to earn my love or approval.
Well, and you can have rules in a way that it creates the atmosphere you want. Rather, you can have one rule that covers 12 other things. I know I didn't realize when I was growing up, I did not have a curfew. I finally figured out like my junior year of high school. And so I did the same thing with my kids. Whenever I was going somewhere, my parents just asked, well, you know, where are you going? Who are you going to be with? What are you going to do? And one of the questions was, when will you be home? Mm-hmm. And one day I went to my dad and I was like, hey, I don't remember what it was. You know, there's a dance or there's this event and I want to stay out later. Can I come, you know, can I change my curfew? And he said, you don't have a curfew. I'm like, what do you mean I don't have a curfew? You know, like I thought I had a curfew. And so things like that, like in our house, just there doesn't have to be a rule about where you can be on school nights and what time you have to be home on different days of the week and when you can and can't have a car. We just go through that conversation. Well, what is it that you want to do? And what do you need to support you in that? And how does that mesh with what other family members need? And for us, those conversations are more support building. And those things create that foundation for the good communication. I mentioned my daughter went through a tough time and at one point she was having panic attacks. And when I discovered that, she hadn't been ready to talk about it. But we'd been building this foundation and building this foundation. And I just sat and listened to her talk. And as you said, I didn't jump in. I wish I'd had your phrase, how can I best support you? I love that better than anything I've ever said to my kids. But I was just quiet and it took her time. But once she realized I wasn't going to tell her what to do or run her life, that I was just there for her and listening to her, then she opened up. And I think that's what's happened. You know, it sounds to me like what's happened with your kids is you've built this foundation and now they know that you're just there for them because you love them and you want to be with them. And yes, your mom, and there will be rules and there may be consequences for things, but that's okay because they know at the base of it that you just love them.
I think that there will always, Sandy, there's always going to be new apps. There's going to be new drugs. There's going to be things that we're not going to see coming at us as parents of teenagers, or parents in general, right? But the best defense we have against these things that our children might get involved in is to build the kind of relationship that is very open in communication, that they feel heard and valued and validated in their feelings. It doesn't mean we have to agree with them, just to validate where they're, you know, see where they're coming from and listen to them. I think that's one of the things that I wasn't doing as much with my first child. You know, I've really tried to learn as I've gone along. And I think our children need to be seen and heard for who they are, and not who we might want them to be. And we've, in order to do that, we've got to be emotionally well connected to ourselves. So a lot of times I think when there's addiction or challenges with that, you know, parents might go to a consequences punitive kind of angry place because they don't know what else to do, but also because there might be bigger issues and challenges going on within the family that would mean that they have to address those things in order to deal with what's going on with their child. So this is also a plea to parents to, if your child's in that situation, to really get honest with yourself about what might be contributing to whatever's going on and take responsibility for taking care of yourself in the situation.
I love that. And you know, I was going to summarize, but you just did 3/4 of it. So there is that. And then reach out for help. Even if your child isn't ready to accept help, then reach out for help for you. And if you go to your family doctor and, you know, cause that's where you went first and they're not giving you a good place, keep going, keep asking. There are many resources out there. There are many different ways of handling things. There are Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. There are all kinds of organizations. You can look things up online. You can talk to people in your community, but find help for you, even if your child isn't ready. And if your child is open to it, and it doesn't have to be, hey, yes, if there is a definite addiction, that's one thing. Like I said earlier, though, we want to be looking for signs that our child needs help handling emotions in a healthy way. And if they don't seem to be able to do that, start sharing with them ideas and things that you do, or finding resources in the area, or saying, you know what, I've noticed this in myself and I think I'm seeing it in some of the other people in the family. So, hey folks, you know, let's work on this. But bottom line is, don't bury our heads in the sand, build the communication and support our kids along the way. And Kim, you were on the show before. I wanted to mention again, let's see what we said. That was show 55, which is a great dovetail to this conversation. So I highly recommend listening to episode 55. And for anyone who's listening who would like to connect with you further, where can they find you?
Well, I have a website. It's reallifeparentguide.com. That's just one L. So reallifeparentguide.com. You can find out about the different services I offer, and absolutely really want to impress on the fact that someone, if they're in this situation with their child, the importance of getting support for yourself in this, for sure. Such a good point, Sandy.
And of course, we will have links for Kim's site, and I'll get a link for her book as well, and put all of that in the show notes at mightyparenting.com. So thank you so much, Mighty Parents, for joining us today and being part of the Mighty Parenting community. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player. It is free everywhere. And also like, share it with other people. Remember, if you're here, you're a Mighty Parent. We're here to support you, and we will see you next week.